The shadow clock. The poles changed their locations. All latitudes were displaced. The axis changed its direction. The number of days in the year increased from 360 to 365 and a quarter, a fact demonstrated in a following section. The length of the day probably also altered. Of course, a sundial or shadow clock from before 687 BC can no longer serve the purpose for which it was devised, but it might well be of use in proving our assumption. Such a clock, originating from the period between circa 850 and 720 BC, was found in Fayum in Egypt at a latitude of 27 degrees. A horizontal slab with hour marks has at one end a shadow-casting vertical hob. The Egyptian day was divided into hours that represented equal portions of time between sunrise and sunset, independently of the length of the day. This shadow clock cannot show correctly the change of time in Fayum or elsewhere in Egypt. A scholar who investigated its working came to the conclusion that it must have been kept with its head to the east in the forenoon and the west in the afternoon, and several scholars agreed that this was the way to use the clock. But this arrangement by itself did not make it possible to read the time. Quote, "Since all actual hour shadows lie substantially closer to the hob than the corresponding marks of the instrument, the shadow casting edge must have been higher over the shadow receiving plane than we find it to be. The upper edge cannot be the shadow caster of the instrument. It must have been on a parallel line above this edge. The marks were also not made on the basis of actual observations, but must have been taken from some theory or other." But as a critic remarked, "This theory implies that at no season of the year did the clock denote the hours correctly, without an hourly alteration of the height of that part of the instrument which cast the shadow. As the clock has no device to adjust the height of the head, it is improbable that this hourly manipulation took place. Besides, in order to change the height of the head every hour, in itself an impractical method, it would have been necessary to have another clock to show the hours without any manipulation, thus indicating the exact moment when the first clock had to be adjusted. But if there was a clock that could show the hours correctly without adjustment, what purpose did the shadow clock serve?" Another explanation has therefore been offered for the manner in which the Egyptian sundial was used. The author of the new idea supposes that at some early date, the precession of the equinoxes being taken into consideration, the shadow clock was used at some latitude in Egypt on the day of the summer solstice. He admits, "Count has, however, not been taken of change in the declination of the sun between sunrise and sunset. For other seasons of the year, it would be necessary at each hour, or each clock reading, either to alter the height of the hob, or tilt this clock, or both. Indeed, when the sun had south declination, and even when it had slight north declination, it would always be necessary to do both. The inference is, therefore, that the clock was originally used at or near the time of the summer solstice." The problem of adjustment for each reading once more crops up in this explanation, again requiring some better means of knowing the exact time. The conclusion at which the author of this explanation arrives, that originally the clock was built for a single day, is rather odd and defies the very purpose for which clocks are constructed. And even if a clock were to be read only once a year, the author of this theory could not make the specimen found in Fayum work, but only a similar clock that had been found broken in pieces, and this he could do only by having recourse to the precession of the equinoxes, and by referring the clock to a period many hundreds of years earlier than chronologists assume. The shadow clock found at Fayum, built under the Libyan dynasty between about 850 and 720 before the present era, may help us to learn the length of the day, the inclination of the pole to the ecliptic, and the latitudes of Egypt in that historical period. A change in any of these three factors would have made the clock obsolete as an instrument for time reading, and probably all three factors did change. We do not possess the sundial of King Ahaz, but we do have the shadow clock used in Egypt in the period before the last catastrophe of 687 BC and possibly before the catastrophe of 747. The water clock. Besides the gnomon or sundial, the Egyptians used the water clock, which had the advantage over the former of showing time during the night as well as during the day. A complete example was found in the Amon Temple of Karnak, Thebes, 25.5 degrees north of the equator. This water clock dates from the time of Amenhotep III of the 18th dynasty, father of Akhenaten. The jar has an opening through which water flows out. Marks are incised on the inner surface of the jar to indicate the time. Since the Egyptian day was divided into hours, which changed in length with the length of the day, the jar has different sets of markings for the various seasons of the year. Four time points are prominently important: the autumnal equinox, the winter solstice, the vernal equinox, and the summer solstice. The equinoxes have equal days and nights in all latitudes, but on the solstices, when either the day or the night is the longest of the year, the length of the daylight varies with the latitude. The farther from the equator, the greater is the difference between the day and the night on the day of the solstice. The difference also depends on the inclination of the equator to the plane of the orbit or ecliptic, which is at present 23.5 degrees. Should this inclination change, or in other words, should the polar axis change its astronomical position, direction, or should the polar axis change its geographical position with each pole shifting to another point, the length of the day and night, on any day except the equinoxes, would change too. The water clock of Amenhotep III presented its investigator with a very strange time scale. Calculating the length of the day of the winter solstice, he found that the clock was constructed for a day of 11 hours 18 minutes, whereas the day of the solstice at 25 degrees north latitude is 10 hours 26 minutes, a difference of 52 minutes. Similarly, the builder of the clock reckoned the night of the winter solstice to be 12 hours 42 minutes, whereas it is 13 hours 34 minutes, 52 minutes too short. On the summer solstice, the longest day, the clock anticipated a day of 12 hours 48 minutes, whereas it is 13 hours and 41 minutes, and a night of 11 hours 12 minutes, whereas it is 10 hours 19 minutes. On the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, the day is 11 hours and 56 minutes long, and the clock actually shows 11 hours and 56 minutes. The night is 12 hours 4 minutes long, and the clock shows exactly 12 hours 4 minutes. The difference between the present values and the values of the day for which the clock is adjusted is very consistent. On the winter solstice, the day of the clock is 52 minutes longer than the present day of the winter solstice in Karnak, and the night is 52 minutes shorter. On the summer solstice, the day is 53 minutes shorter on the clock, and the night 53 minutes longer. The figures on the clock show a smaller difference between the length of daylight on the solstices, or between the longest and shortest days of the year, than is observed at Karnak at the present time. Thus, the water clock of Amenhotep III, if it was correctly built and correctly interpreted, indicates that either Thebes was closer to the equator, or that the inclination of the equator toward the ecliptic was less than the present angle of 23.5 degrees. In either case, the climate of the latitudes of Egypt could not have been the same as it is in our age. As we find from the present research, the clock of Amenhotep III became obsolete in the middle of the 8th century, and the clock that might have replaced it at that time would have been made obsolete in the catastrophes of the end of the 8th and the beginning of the 7th centuries, when once more the axis changed its direction in the sky and its position on the globe as well. A hemisphere travels southward. Behold, the world bowing with its massive dome, earth an expanse of sea and heaven's depth. Virgil's Eclogues. The change in the position of the poles carried the polar ice outside the new polar circle, while other regions were brought into the polar circle. There is nothing imperative in the present position of the pole or in the direction of the polar axis. No known astronomical or geological law requires the present direction of the axis and the present position of the pole. I find a similar thought in the writings of Schiaparelli. Quote, "The permanence of the geographical poles in the very same regions of the earth cannot yet be considered as incontestably established by astronomical or mechanical arguments. Such permanence may be a fact today, but it remains a matter to be proven for the preceding ages of the history of the globe. Our problem, so important from the astronomical and mathematical standpoint, touches the foundation of geology and paleontology. Its solution is tied to the problem of the most grandiose events in the history of the Earth. End quote. The present pole was not always the terrestrial pole, nor did the changes occur in a slow process. The glacial sheet was a polar cover. The ice ages terminated with catastrophic suddenness. Regions of mild climate moved instantly into the polar circle. The ice sheet in America and Europe started to melt. Great quantities of vapor rising from the surface of the oceans caused increased precipitation and the formation of a new ice cover. Gigantic waves that traveled across continents, more than the movement of the ice, were responsible for the drift, especially in the north, and for the boulders that were carried long distances and placed atop unrelated formations. If we look at the distribution of the ice sheet in the northern hemisphere, we see that a circle, with its center somewhere near the east shore of Greenland or in the strait between Greenland and Baffinland near the present North Magnetic Pole, and a radius of about 3,600 kilometers, embraces the regions of the ice sheet of the last glacial age. Northeastern Siberia is outside the circle. The valley of the Missouri, down to 39 degrees north latitude, is within the circle. The eastern part of Alaska is included, but not its western part. Northwestern Europe is well within the circle. Some distance beyond the Ural Mountains, the line curves toward the north and crosses the present polar circle. Now we reflect. Was not the North Pole at some time in the past 20 degrees or more distant from the point it now occupies, and closer to America? In like manner, the old South Pole would have been roughly the same 20 degrees from the present pole. The Brahman charts of the sky show a large difference from what modern astronomers would expect to find. Calcutta being removed 180 degrees longitude from Baffinland, the Brahman charts would rather correspond to a position of the Earth in which the axis would pierce the globe at Baffinland, close to the present magnetic pole. The change in latitudes of other regions to the west and to the east of India would have been smaller. It is probable that 27 centuries ago, or perhaps 35, the present North Pole was at Baffinland, or close to the Boothia Felix Peninsula of the American mainland. The sudden extermination of mammoths was caused by a catastrophe and probably resulted from asphyxiation or electrocution. The immediately subsequent movement of the Siberian continent into the polar region is probably responsible for the preservation of the corpses. Here we have a relevant footnote. Greek authors referred to the mummifying quality of ambrosia. They described the process of pouring the fluid ambrosia into the noses of the dead. This was the process used by the Egyptians and also in applying their drugs for mummification. The Babylonians used honey for that purpose. Back to the original text. It appears that the mammoths, along with other animals, were killed by a tempest of gases accompanied by a spontaneous lack of oxygen caused by fires raging high in the atmosphere. A few instants later, their dying or dead bodies were moving into the polar circle. In a few hours, northeastern America moved from the frigid zone of the polar circle into a moderate zone. Northeastern Siberia moved in the opposite direction from the moderate zone to the polar circle. The present cold climate of northern Siberia started when the glacial age in Europe and America came to a sudden end. It is assumed here that in historical times neither northeastern Siberia nor western Alaska were in the polar regions, but that as a result of the catastrophes of the 8th and 7th centuries, this area moved into that region. This assumption implies that these lands, to the extent that they were not covered by the sea, were most probably places of human habitation. Archaeological work should be undertaken in northeastern Siberia with the purpose of establishing whether these now uninhabited tundras were sites of culture 27 centuries ago. In 1939 and 1940, quote, one of the most startling and important finds of the century, E. Stephenson, was made at Point Hope in Alaska on the shores of the Bering Strait. an ancient city of about 800 houses, whose population had been larger than that of the modern city of Fairbanks, was discovered there, north of 68 degrees, about 130 miles within the Arctic Circle. Relevant footnote, by F.G. Rainey and his colleagues under the sponsorship of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the results of their expedition were published in the anthropological papers of the museum. Back to the original text, quote, Ipiutek, as the location of this ancient city is called by the present Eskimos, must have been built before the Christian era. 2,000 years is thought a conservative estimate of its age. The excavations have yielded beautiful ivory carvings unlike any known Eskimo or other American Indian culture of the northern regions. Fashioned of logs, the strange tombs gave up skeletons, which stared up at the excavators with artificial eyeballs carved of ivory and inlaid with jet. Numerous delicately made and engraved implements, also found in the graves, resembled some of those produced in North China 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Others resemble carvings of the Ainu peoples in northern Japan and the natives of the Amur River in Siberia. The material culture of these people was not a simple one, of the kind usually found in the Arctic, but elaborate and that of a sophisticated people, in this sense more advanced than any known Eskimos and clearly derived from Eastern Asia. End quote. Description by Evelyn Stephenson in her book Here is Alaska. In central Alaska, where the ground has been frozen for many centuries, animals with flesh still attached to their bones have been excavated. Quote, bones of extinct as well as living species of mammals have been found in most of the regions. They remain not as fossilized bones, but in a frozen state, and in some cases, ligaments, skin, and flesh adhere to the bones. During the season of 1938, quote, almost the entire skin of a super bison, the hairs remaining, was found in the Fairbanks area. Quote, some of the artifacts found after the stripping at depths of 18 to 20 meters below the original surface may have been on or near the surface originally, but the position of others tends to associate them with extinct animal bones at great depths. The recognizable artifacts are implements of chipped stone, bone, and ivory. End quote. In 1936 to 1937, in a small area designated as Esther, several implements were found, as well as numerous burned stones in association with mammoth, mastodon, bison, and horse bones at the bottom of the muck deposits in Esther Creek, some 20 meters below the original surface. In 1938, similar finds were made at Engineer Creek at the bottom of the muck, 40 meters below the original surface of the soil. These vestiges of life and culture far beneath the surface of the ground are, for the most part, remnants buried in catastrophes prior to that described in the present chapter. Among them are also remains of culture and life engulfed in the cataclysms of the 8th and 7th centuries. When the Earth's rotation was disturbed, waves of translation moved eastward because of inertia, and poleward because of the recession of the waters from the equatorial bulge where they are held by the rotation of the Earth. Thus, Alaska must have been swept by waters from the Pacific. Towns similar to those unearthed in Alaska, and possibly larger ones, will most likely be found in Kamchatka or farther to the north on the Kaluma or Lena rivers flowing into the Arctic Ocean. The conditions that preserved mammoths with flesh and skin on their bones must have had the same effect on human beings, and it is not excluded that human bodies encased in ice will be found too. A problem the archaeologists will have to solve is that of clarifying whether the extermination of life in these regions of Northwest America and Northeast Asia, resulting in the death of mammoths, took place in the 8th and 7th centuries, or 15th century before the present era, or earlier. In other words, whether the herds of mammoths were annihilated in the days of Isaiah or in the days of the Exodus.